Archaeologists working in one of the most impenetrable rainforests in Guatemala have stumbled on a remarkable discovery, a room full of wall paintings and numerical calculations. The buried room apparently was a workshop used by scribes or astronomers working for a Mayan king. The paintings depict the king and members of his court, and the numbers mark important periods in the Mayan calendar. NPR's Christopher Joyce has more on the workshop of Xultun.
The room is about the size of a walk-in closet. It's part of the buried Maya city of Xultun. There are painted murals on three walls, a resplendent king, and four other figures. Maya paintings this old, the site dates to the 9th century, are very rare. Tropical weather usually destroys them. But David Stewart, an anthropologist at the University of Texas at Austin, says the numbers are the most intriguing discovery.
The wall is covered in numbers, and this is something that really got our attention very early on. This was an unusual thing about the Xultun mural.
Stewart says some of the numbers are calendars for Maya ceremonies or for the cycles of the moon, Venus, and Mars. Some calculations appear to be efforts to predict lunar eclipses.
It's kind of like having a whiteboard in your office where you're writing down formulas that you want to remember if you're a physicist or a mathematician. And it's amazing that it's on the wall. It's not in a book.
Mayan numbers are written with bars and dots. Their use in calendars and astronomy is well known from a Maya book called the Dresden Codex. It was written on the bark of a fig tree, but the Xultun murals are centuries older than the book. Writing in the journal Science, the scientists say the murals confirm what Maya archaeologists have been saying for years. The Maya calendar does not predict the end of time at the year 2012, as some New Age prophets have argued. In fact, the murals register future time stretching far beyond 2012. Archaeologist William Saturno from Boston University compares Maya calendars to a car's odometer.
If we're driving a car, we don't anticipate that at 100,000 miles, the car will vanish from beneath us. We know that it'll reset to zero, and the next tenth of a mile we go, we'll have another number to look at.
What these Mayan timekeepers were doing was simply marking the passage of time from past to future, but in discrete intervals. The buried city of Xultun was discovered in 1915, but was so hard to get to that archaeologists mostly ignored it. Saturno started exploring it in 2008. His team found the mural room 2 years later. They got an emergency grant from the National Geographic Society to dig into it. Looters had stolen everything removable, but the murals and the numbers remained. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
This is NPR News. Gideon Lewis Kraus was confused. A few years ago, the American 20-something was living in Berlin, hanging out in art galleries and nameless speakeasies, preoccupied with living a creatively meaningful life, but kind of unsure about what that meant or how to make it happen. So when a friend asked him to join him on a pilgrimage in Spain, he went, hoping to find some answers. After Spain, Lewis Kraus went on to complete two other famous pilgrimages, one in Japan and one in the Ukraine. The result of that experience is a new memoir called A Sense of Direction. Gideon Lewis Kraus joins us now from our New York studios. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thanks so much for having me, Rachel.
So tell me a little bit about the first trip you go on is with a friend of yours, Tom,
right.
Also a writer. And the trip, this is a famous pilgrimage. This is a religious pilgrimage, right?
Well, this is one of the interesting things. It was a fairly serious religious pilgrimage for 1,000 years. And then in the last 30 years, it's become strangely ahistorically popular with a young, mostly secular crowd. So we met almost nobody who was doing it for explicitly religious reasons. These days, what most people do is they start at the French-Spanish border on the French side of the Pyrenees, and they walk to Santiago de Compostela. It's about 550 miles. Takes most people about a month.
Thousands of people do this particular walk in Spain every year. And you describe in the book this greeting that people
give. Buen camino.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That pilgrims give one another on
very,
the trail.
Very, very useful because it can mean a whole variety of things. Hello, it very frequently means goodbye, as in, like, it was nice to meet you, walk on. You know, you would meet someone and like them, and then you would spend a week walking with them, and then all of a sudden, buen camino. It was simultaneously the, like, have a good, spiritually satisfying, meaningful journey, and also, like, buzz off. I'm tired of seeing you.
I noticed, though, there's also a lot of judging on the trail. I mean, you kind of think of the pilgrimage and pilgrims as being these very humble, kind of enlightened souls. But it gets kind of catty. You start judging people, differentiating people who do the entire trail and those who kind of cut in.
Yeah. Anybody who started even 10 feet after you was an inauthentic pilgrim, was not doing the whole thing. And it's just a way of differentiating yourself as you go along and dealing with the anxiety you have about doing this absurd thing.
You come out of your experience in Spain and you don't stop there. You decide you want to take another journey, this time in Japan.
Well, so while I was on the Camino in Spain, I met these two Japanese people. And two of them got very excited and said, we have this thing, the Shikoku Ohenro. It's sort of like the Japanese Camino. And I looked it up, and it's this circuit of 88 Buddhist temples that ring the smallest of the four Japanese islands. And it's very similar to the Camino. It also was wildly popular during the Middle Ages because in Japan it was literally the only reason under the feudal shoguns, the only reason you could leave home was if you were on a religious pilgrimage. It's a little less than 900 miles. It takes most people about 6 weeks, and maybe 10 to 12 foreigners do it a year. So I met two other foreigners while I was there.
So this is a fundamental difference from the experience that you just had in Spain. In that experience, there were all these people and pilgrims, and it was this communal experience.
Yes.
In Japan, you're alone, basically.
I was very, very alone. I met almost nobody. I went weeks without talking to anyone. It's almost all on asphalt, as opposed to the Camino, which is all on these nice paths. And it was raining the whole time. But this is hard.
This is kind of what you think of as like the pilgrimage.
Exactly.
And you're alone. And,
exactly.
I mean, in some ways, was that a more authentic experience?
Well, I mean, one of the questions that I talk about in the book is what does this authenticity even mean? Because there are a lot of people who say, well, this isn't authentic anymore. It used to be this religious thing, and now it's just this kind of backpacker jaunt. And ultimately, these are all distinctions I reject. I say, you know, the fact that your feet are coming apart and the fact that you've been walking for 8 hours in the rain, I mean, like, authenticity is the last thing that you care about.
Gideon, you are using these walks to try to do some thinking about the relationship you've had with your dad.
Right.
Which becomes a central theme in the book. And for your final pilgrimage, you set out to go to Ukraine. It's not so much a long walk as this kind of massive gathering to pay homage to a Jewish mystic. And you invite your brother and your dad to join you on this.
Mm-hmm. Well, so the book had, as I had gone on, the book had really become about this idea of pilgrimage as pretext, that it was always a pretext to leave home. It was a pretext to take some time to think about your life. It was a pretext to think about forgiveness and all these things. And then I thought, okay, well, if this is about the kind of pretext you need to make to try to change your life, I'm going to use this Jewish pilgrimage as a pretext to have all of the conversations with my dad about his life and his sexuality.
We should say he was
he came out late
in life.
So my dad came out when I was 19. So I thought, like, okay, we're going to use this ridiculous Jewish pilgrimage that I basically have no interest in, full of, like, all these Hasids that I definitely do not identify with, to have these conversations with my dad.
You guys just couldn't go to a deli on the Upper West Side and call
it a
day?
Well, no. See, that's the thing about pilgrimage, is that if you go to a deli, then you're just – it's like another day that you're at a deli, whereas, like, if you fly to the Ukraine – the whole idea of pilgrimage is that you're hoping that – you're going to rise to the occasion in some way, right? So you hope that there is going to be something structural about the idea of making a miserable trip. I mean, we had this terrible trip on Aeroflot, and we finally got there, and then we had to drive through Ukraine in the night, fearing about getting chickened down by cops. So all of these, you know, minor but real austerities then, I think, primed us to be like, we're in a special place doing a special thing. We're going to rise to the occasion of having really serious and candid talks here that we would not have in a deli on the Upper West Side.
Did it work? Did you get what you wanted?
It did. I mean, it was absolutely exceeded all of my expectations, really. It was amazing. By the end of it, we kind of had to flee in haste from these Hasids because we had just had too much. So we, like, ran out with our suitcases and our unkosher meat and got into the rental car and shook off the Ukrainian cops and, like, got onto the highway and just, like, we're on our way to Odessa and just breathed a sigh of relief. And then we had just had this great vacation. And it felt completely different. It felt like something really new. It felt like a way that the three of us hadn't been together in a really long time.
Author Gideon Lewis Krause, his new memoir is called A Sense of Direction. He spoke with us from our New York studios. Gideon, thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Rachel. This has been great.
U.S. patent number D486486 reads, quote, a display device with a movable assembly attached to a flat panel display and to a base, end quote. Then there's patent number D469109 for, quote, the ornamental design for a media player, substantially as shown and described. Those are just a couple of the hundreds of patents that bear the name Steven P. Jobs, the late CEO of Apple. A new exhibition opened on Friday at the Smithsonian's Ripley Center here in Washington, D.C., and it's titled The Patents and Trademarks of Steve Jobs, Art and Technology That Changed the World. Walter Isaacson is the author of Steve Jobs' biography. He joins us now in our studio. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you very much for having me, Rachel.
So when we think of the pantheon of great American inventors, Edison and Ford, the Wright brothers come to mind. Based on the work that you did and your relationship with Steve Jobs, does he belong in that company?
Oh, absolutely. And he had the greatest design collaboration of our day and era, which is he and Johnny Ive, who is the great industrial designer at Apple. And you mentioned the display device with movable arms or whatever. That's the famous sort of sunflower-looking iMac that they did, I think, you know, in the early 2000s. And it came about when a flat screen was developed. And Johnny had created something in which the screen was attached to the computer, and it didn't feel like it had real integrity. And Jobs was kind of annoyed, and he went home. And his wife, who plants this beautiful garden behind the house in Palo Alto, had planted sunflowers, a profusion of them. And when Johnny came over, they were sitting there and walking around, and they just looked at the sunflowers and how there's a certain essence of the sunflower and how it floats above the plant. And that became that iMac, and of course, Steve Jobs and Johnny Ive have their names on the design patent.
Is the credit that Steve Jobs is given for these patents deserved insofar as his ability to kind of identify something like that sunflower? Yeah. I mean, is that as valuable as being able to put it into making something out of it?
Well, one of the things Steve was able to do is conceive great designs, but also execute them. He had an intuitive feel for things. Like at one point, Johnny Ive showed him a recessed handle that was on that beautiful iMac of, I think, the late 1990s. It felt like it had just hopped on your desk. I don't know if you remember the rabbit-looking iMac. It had a handle, and the handle wasn't truly necessary. This was a desktop machine, but Johnny Ive explained it makes it friendly. People are afraid to touch computers, but having a recessed handle makes it just say to you, you can touch me. I'm at your service. And that's what Steve Jobs understood.
And it was every step of product development, packaging even.
You know, he was taught in the early 1980s by a great guy named Mike Markala that the packaging really matters. You have to impute a beauty to a product from the moment people see the box. And so he has a design patent with some other people at Apple. I think Steve's name may be first on it, of just the way you open the box to the original iPod and how it is cradled. And you open it and it hinges like a jewel. There's a certain theater, an emotional theater in the unpacking.
Makes me feel like I should wrap my Christmas presents better.
You should.
If you had to pick one, what was one of the fiercest fights that Steve Jobs and Apple had to fight when it came to patents?
Well, obviously the fiercest fight was the fight against Microsoft in the 1980s. And there's a good example of a design, look, and feel. Originally developed at Xerox PARC, which is a graphical user interface, and you're looking at a computer screen now, and it probably has icons like trash cans and folders and documents
and
everything
else. Indeed it does.
Some of those elements were invented at Xerox PARC. Steve made a deal with Xerox that the Apple team could come in, see it, and try to adopt it. And what Steve did was he improved it. You could drag the documents and dump them into folders. You could double-click on the folders, and they would pop open. You could pull down menus. All of these were improvements to the design Apple did. So then Microsoft comes along and pretty much copies a lot of the look and feel of that graphical user interface for Windows. And that was one of the great intellectual property fights of our time, because Steve Jobs felt pretty strongly that Microsoft had ripped off the look and feel of the Macintosh operating system.
You had extraordinary access to him. Did you come away thinking that it was more important for him to be remembered as an artist rather than an incredibly successful revolutionary CEO.
Absolutely. Look, when they do the original Macintosh in 1983, he holds it up for a while because the circuit board isn't beautiful enough for his taste. Now, that's not the way to maximize profits, but it is the way to say, I'm an artist, and even the parts unseen should be beautiful.
Walter Isaacson is the author of Steve Jobs' biography. The patents and trademarks of Steve Jobs' exhibition is on display at the Smithsonian's Ripley Center here in Washington, D.C. until July 8th. Walter Isaacson, thanks so much for coming in.
It was great being with you, Rachel.
You are listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. Travel often brings the unexpected, so Weekend Edition food commentator Bonnie Wolf was unprepared to find some of the best food she has ever eaten in Australia.
We were on Kangaroo Island and stopped at a cafe for lunch. An Australian woman we'd seen earlier at a sheep dairy ran over and recommended the Marin salad. What is Marin? I asked. Well, she said, you know what yabbies are. Toto, we're not in Kansas anymore. We are literally in Oz, which is what the locals call Australia. Like the Emerald City, it is a land of enchantments, many of them culinary. Marin and yabbies are related to crawfish. At the amazing Sydney Fish Market, they sit beside all sorts of other seafood I've never heard of. Balmain bugs, blue-spotted goatfish, mud crabs, and the impossibly delicious barramundi. Because most people live on the coast, they eat a lot of fish. Really, really fresh fish. Another piece of the Australia food puzzle is that one of every four Australians is from somewhere else. This on a continent with fewer people than California. Aboriginal people lived as hunter-gatherers for about 40,000 years before the British started sending criminals to Australia in 1788. Subsequent waves of immigration brought people from all over the world. War, poverty, and politics brought people from Europe, Southeast Asia, India, Africa, and the Middle East. The immigrants found a climate varying from temperate to tropical, where they could grow just about anything year-round. The wine industry flourished, and they grow the best olives. By the end of the 20th century, bad British food was no longer the norm. When a Sydney friend was raising her children in the late 1970s, she sent them to school with Vegemite sandwiches on white bread. Now, her 5-year-old granddaughter takes Lebanese bread with hummus. The school cafeteria serves sushi on Thursdays. The urban food markets made me want to fall to my knees. Quince, passion fruit, custard apples, meat cases filled with ox tongue and beef cheeks, wild boar and, yes, kangaroo, baskets of fresh eggs, cases of local cheese. Stunningly fresh ingredients, cultural diversity, and inventive cooking. Your basic food paradise.
Bonnie Wolf is the contributing editor of NPR's Kitchen Window. You can follow her on Twitter. She's at Bonnie Wolf. Pianist Gil Evans was one of the most important jazz arrangers of the 20th century, an innovator who brought orchestral colors and textures to jazz. He was a pioneer of the cool sound and famous for his collaborations with Miles Davis. Evans was born 100 years ago today. From New York, Tom Vitale has this tribute.
Gil Evans is best known for music he wrote between 1957 and 1963 for his 19-piece orchestra backing trumpeter Miles Davis. The album's Sketches of Spain and Porgy and Bess were hailed for their rich harmonies and use of instruments not usually associated with jazz bands. But in a 1980 interview in a West Side recording studio, Evans said he wanted to use the instruments of a traditional orchestra in a new way.
Many great compositions have been written with the traditional sound of the orchestra. You know, I mean, nothing much has been added to it as far as sound is concerned.
Thank you. Evans gave the orchestra a different sound by creating unusual harmonies using colors he borrowed from Debussy, Ravel, and Stravinsky.
I got the harmonic language from the French, Spanish, and Russian Impressionists, you know? That's where the harmony comes from.
Evans makes it sound easy, but Emil Charlap, a music copyist who worked with Evans in the 1950s, filling out and finishing his scores, says the arranger labored to create that new sound.
He sat there all night and composed. I had a secretary who worked for me, who lived upstairs, and she told me that she can't sleep because Gil is there all night, and he plays F, 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 all night long. And that was like the beginning of Sketches of Spain.
Gil Evans arranged Sketches of Spain in Charlap's West 48th Street offices.
Gil was beyond belief. He would work on one thing forever. He wanted it to be the note. He would write a whole arrangement and leave out one note and come back 2 weeks later to put that right note in.
Evans spent a lifetime creating a new sound for a jazz orchestra, and he did it without any musical education. He was born in Toronto on May 13, 1912, then moved with his family to Stockton, California. He said he learned how to handle a popular song from copying the arrangements on early Louis Armstrong records. In the 1930s, he led his own dance band in Stockton, but his music became more complex when he joined bandleader Claude Thornhill's orchestra in 1941. Then, in the late 1940s, Evans met Miles Davis. Their initial collaboration grew out of informal jam sessions at the arranger's apartment on 52nd Street, where some of the best young beboppers in town showed up. The result was a series of recordings that came to be known as The Birth of the Cool. These recordings are credited with launching the cool sound in jazz. Among the musicians was a young French horn player, Gunther Schuller. Now a world-renowned composer, Schuller says the arrangements were amazing.
For example, a piece called Moon Dreams, which was written by Glenn Miller's pianist and had a certain popularity, but Gil Evans just recomposed this piece in his own, at much more advanced style. He composed this coda, which starts with a dramatically dissonant chord. And over a period of about, well, let's say a minute and a half, the music subsides, it gets softer and softer, and it finally comes to a very beautiful, soft ending. And it's just an incredible piece of composition. How he came up with that back in 1948-49, it's just beyond even my comprehension, and I knew him very well.
Gil Evans wrote dozens of scores that were never recorded. Composer Ryan Truesdell spent the last 3 years unearthing 50 of them. Truesdell assembled a modern orchestra to record 10 of those songs for a record released today, for Evans' birthday, called Centennial, Newly Discovered Works of Gil Evans. Truesdell says what makes Gil Evans's sound distinctive is an air of mystery that comes from the space between the notes and his chords.
It's almost like a cloud that the music is able to float on. And with like the brass section, for instance, is he would write four, maybe five note voicings, but instead of putting them really spaced out so they took up all that range from bottom to top, he would put them all together. And then all of a sudden, there's this all this air between the bass and these instruments. And they so it kind of gives it a floaty, very light effect.
In the 1960s, Gil Evans updated his orchestra with electric guitars and synthesizers, but he continued to harmonize with his close-note chords. In 1983, a week before his 71st birthday, Evans sat at the piano in his cramped apartment on West 76th Street, took a toke on the marijuana in his pipe, and showed me how he harmonized the Jimi Hendrix song, Up From the Skies.
I wrote the melody out exactly as he sang it, right? Comes in and sings, right? I just want to talk to you. I don't mean you no harm. So what I did was I harmonized it when he'd say, and I give it a certain sound by saying, see? That gives me a sound, right? You hear that sound, right? It's got a certain spice to it, right? Because the notes are close.
Gil Evans said he never made a cent off any of his records, but he was cool with that.
You know, I just started out as an arranger. If I'd have known at the time that it was such a loser's game, I wouldn't have done it. Because the arranger doesn't get any royalties. I had so much fun doing it, I never even thought of that at the time.
Gil Evans said there was no use complaining about the past. He was only interested in what was happening now. He died at the age of 75 in 1988. For NPR News, I'm Tom Vitale in New York.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Rachel Martin.
And if you're just joining us, this is Weekends on All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Guy Raz.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, here's Johnny!
50 years ago, Johnny Carson became the host of The Tonight Show. And during his 30 years as host, he reached a nightly audience of 15 million people. He became one of the most trusted and famous men in America. But Carson was intensely private off-screen, and very few people, including members of his own family, really knew him. Documentary filmmaker Peter Jones wanted to try and change that, and so once a year for 15 years, Jones sent Johnny Carson a letter begging him for permission to make a documentary on his life.
Dear Mr. Carson, my diary tells me it's been another year since my last attempt.
That's Peter Jones reading an excerpt from a letter dated January 10th, 2003. 8 weeks after that letter was sent, Jones finally received a phone call from the man himself.
And he said, Peter, I admire your persistence and your style, but I'm not going to do anything because I don't give a S-H
fill in the blank. Gotcha, right. He did not want to cooperate with your desire to make a documentary about his life.
I think he had deep regrets, especially about his personal life. He loved all the wives he was married to. There were four of them. And they genuinely loved him, too. But he had deep regrets that that, you know, did not work out because he had this problem with philandering. And also, he deeply regretted his relationship to his three sons, or frankly, lack of relationship with his three sons.
In the documentary, you talked to many, many people who worked with him, Doc Severinsen and his writers and people like Dick Cavett. And everyone, including, to some extent, one of his wives that you interviewed, his second wife, Joanne, they said, you never really knew Johnny. You never got to really know him.
I think there was Johnny Carson that America saw, and then there was John William Carson that he kept to himself. Johnny Carson, he was most content playing in the autumn leaves, you know, in Nebraska, or playing solitaire, or playing the drums. He was really, you know, content to just be with himself. Johnny Carson did not really exist anywhere else but in front of the camera. Privately, he was John William Carson.
Early on, a Time magazine reporter goes to Nebraska, interviews Johnny Carson's mom, watches the opening monologue with her, and she says that wasn't very funny. Jack Parr was edgier when he did the show. And that really hurt Johnny Carson.
And it is not insignificant to note this was a cover story article in 1967. Johnny Carson had been on the show for 5 years as the host. He was on top of the world. And for his mother to make that comment, it devastated him. And after he read that, he broke down and cried.
Peter, you interviewed many, many people who worked with Johnny Carson, writers and colleagues. You spoke to his second wife, Joanne, but you did not talk to any of his other wives or either of his surviving children. Why not?
I did talk off the record to two other wives, Joanna and Alex Carson. I did not talk to the boys. There was and remains a veil of secrecy surrounding Johnny Carson. They chose not to talk to me on the record because they felt they were honoring posthumously his wishes.
I'm speaking with documentary filmmaker Peter Jones. His new film is called Johnny Carson, King of Late Night. One of the things that he was able to do was to sort of be political and funny, but not partisan.
Tonight's monologue is is dedicated to President Nixon. I've got a monologue that just won't quit.
He really went after Nixon during the Watergate period. He went after Bill Clinton, too. Some of it was with a wink and a nod.
Finally, some good political news. Bill Clinton has laryngitis, lost his voice.
And yet nobody knew what his politics were.
That is true. He struck a remarkable balance. He made fun of Democrats as well as Republicans. My hunch is that he would be a Democrat. But I know I can't, you know, confirm that. I know he was very close to the Reagans, to Ronald and Nancy Reagan, who admired him. She did not like the jokes.
World War III was just declared. I'm just kidding, of course, not really. I just wanted to get Reagan out of bed to watch the monologue.
She, as everyone knows, was very protective of her husband, and she would call and say, you know, that wasn't funny. But he nevertheless persisted because he was an equal opportunity offender.
He was somebody who made careers. I mean, he would bring comics on, and that was it. He gave you the thumbs up, and you were made. He did that for Jerry Seinfeld and Ray Romano and, of course, Joan Rivers, who became a very close friend and then betrayed him.
Joan Rivers broke Johnny's heart in a way I don't think even any of the failed marriages did, because this was someone he genuinely appreciated as a funny person, but also really liked.
No, my wedding night was a disaster. You know that. A lot of men smoke after they make love. Edgar smoked during. Now, that's... Ask me for a light. You think that's nice? I say, get it yourself on the dashboard. What's the matter?
He felt so betrayed and brokenhearted when she called to tell him about her show well after he had found out about it.
Her show on Fox.
Her show on Fox.
And he had already found out about it through media leaks.
Yes, he found out about it, and when she called him, he hung up on her and famously never spoke to her again. And in the film, for the first time, she acknowledges, perhaps I should have called him sooner.
Peter, throughout his time on The Tonight Show, and even before when he, in his previous role as a game show host, he worked with Ed McMahon. He actually hired Ed McMahon. And they were very tight, these guys who'd go out drinking. But somewhere around the middle of The Tonight Show's run, that ended. And there was quite a bit of tension between them, right?
There was tension always between Johnny and Ed on The Tonight Show because Johnny felt that Ed was intruding on him and his jokes at times.
My next guest doesn't really need an introduction, but my what?
Your first guest.
What did I say?
My next guest.
Well, he is my next guest.
Oh. It's also happens to be your first guest.
That's right. Yes. It could be either one, first and next.
Yes. Which is it?
It's my first and next guest.
Ed would anticipate what Johnny was going to say and would sometimes say it, and that would upset Johnny tremendously. And there were a few occasions where the producer of The Tonight Show warned Ed that he could go if he didn't stop taking some of the laughs from Johnny.
But, of course, Johnny needed Ed, and, of course, Ed needed Johnny. I mean, that was part of the brand.
Absolutely. It was, as David Letterman says in the film, it was Laurel and Hardy. You can't have one without the other.
What was it that you learned while making this film that surprised you, that you didn't know about Johnny Carson?
What surprised me was frankly how little we could find about his interior life. I think we find as much as anybody has to date, but what was remarkable to me was still how protective he was of this impenetrable part of his persona. I hope we suggest clues, but I don't know if we really got it.
You people watching, I can only tell you that it has been an honor and a privilege to come into your homes all these years and entertain you. And I hope when I find something that I want to do and I think you will like and come back that you'll be as gracious inviting me into your home as you have been. I bid you a very heartfelt good night.
Johnny Carson's farewell 20 years ago this month. Peter Jones's documentary is called Johnny Carson, King of Late Night. It premieres tomorrow night on PBS stations across the country.
We're drinking, my friend, to the end of a sweet episode. Make it one for my baby and one more for the road.
And for Sunday, that's Weekends and All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Guy Raz. Don't forget to download our podcast, The Best Of. It's called Weekends on All Things Considered. Find it on iTunes or at npr.org/weekendatc. We're back on the radio next weekend with more news, personal stories, books, and music. Until then, thanks for listening, and have a great week.
You could tell me.